One of the first things I think young people, especially nowadays, should learn how to do is see for yourself and listen for yourself and think for yourself, and then you can come to an intelligent decision for yourself. But if you form the habit of going by what you hear others say about someone, or going by what others think about someone, instead of going and searching that thing out for yourself and seeing for yourself, you will be walking west when you think you're going east. You'll be walking east when you think you're going west. So this generation, especially of our people, have a burden upon themselves more so than at any other time in history. The most important thing we can learn how to do today is think for ourselves. It's good to keep wide open ears and listen to what everybody else has to say. But when you come to make a decision, you have to weigh all of what you heard of its own and place it where it belongs. And then come to a decision for yourself, and you'll never regret it. But if you form the habit of taking what someone else says about a thing without checking it out for yourself, you'll find that other people will have you hating your own friends and loving their enemies. And this is one of the things that our people are beginning to learn today, that it's very important to think out a situation for yourself. If you don't do it, then you'll always be maneuvered into actually, you'll never fight your enemies, but you will find yourself fighting your own self. And I think our people in this country are the best examples of that, because many of us want to be nonviolent. I myself would go for nonviolence if it was consistent, if it was intelligent. Everybody was going to be nonviolent. And if we were going to be nonviolent all the time, I'd say, okay, let's get with it. We'll all be nonviolent. But I don't go along, and I'm just telling you how I think. I don't go along with any kind of nonviolence unless everybody's going to be nonviolent. If they make the Ku Klux Klan nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. If they make the White Citizens Council nonviolent, I'll be nonviolent. But as long as you got somebody else not being nonviolent, I don't want anybody to come to me talk any kind of nonviolent talk. And I don't think that it is fair to tell our people to be nonviolent unless someone is out there making the Klan and the Citizens Council and these other groups also be nonviolent. Now, I'm not criticizing those here who are nonviolent. I think everybody should do it the way they feel is best. And I congratulate anybody who can be nonviolent in the face of all that kind of action that I read about in that part of the world. But I don't think that you will find the upcoming generation of our people, especially those who have been doing some thinking, who will go along with any form of nonviolence unless nonviolence is going to be practiced all the way around. If the leaders of the nonviolent movement can go into the white community and teach nonviolence, good. I go along with that. But as long as I see them teaching nonviolence only in the black community, then we can't go along with that. We believe in equality. And equality means you have to put the same thing over here that you put over here. And if just black people alone are going to be the ones who are nonviolent, then it's not fair. We throw ourselves off guard. And in fact, we disarm ourselves and make ourselves defensive. The Organization of Afro-American Unity is a non-religious group of black people in this country who believe that the problems confronting our people in this country need to be reanalyzed and a new approach devised towards trying to get a solution. And studying the problem, we recall that prior to 1939 in this country, all of our people in the North, South, East, and West, no matter how much education we had, were segregated. We were segregated in the North just as much as we were segregated in the South. And even right now, today, there's as much segregation in the North as there is in the South. There's some worse segregation right here in New York City than there is in Macomb, Mississippi. But up here, they're subtle and tricky and deceitful. And they make you think that you got it made when you haven't even begun to make it yet. So realize that prior to 1939, that our people were in a very menial position, our condition. And most of us were waiters and porters and bellhops and dancers and waitresses and things of that sort. And it was not until war was declared in Germany by Hitler and America became involved in a manpower shortage plus she became involved in a manpower, she was paid for the manpower shortage in regards to her factory plus her time. And it was only then that the black man in this country was permitted to make a few strides forward. It was never out of some kind of moral enlightenment or moral awareness on the part of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam only let the black man take a step forward when he himself had his back to the wall. In Michigan, where I was driving at that time, I recall that the best jobs in the city for blacks were waiters out at the country club. And in those days, if you had a job waiting table in the country club, you had it made. Or if you had a job at the state house, having a job at the state house didn't mean that you were a clerk or something of that sort. You had the shoeshine stand in the state house. And just by being in there where you could be around all these big politicians, that made you a big shot Negro. You were shining shoes, but you were a big shot Negro because you were around big shot white people, and you could bend their ear and get up next to them. And you oftentimes in those days were chosen to be the voice of the Negro community. Now, and also right at that time, 1939, 40, 41, they weren't drafting Negroes in the Army nor the Navy. The Negro couldn't join the Navy in 1940 or 41 in this country. And he couldn't join. They wouldn't take a black man in the Navy. They would take him if they wanted him and make him a cook, but he couldn't just go and join the Navy. And he couldn't just go, I don't think he could just go and join the Army. Now, they weren't drafting him when the war first started. And this is what they thought of you and me in those days. For one thing, they didn't trust us. And they feared that if they put us in the Army and trained us on how to use rifles and other things, that we might shoot at some target that they had to face out. So, and we would have. Any thinking man knows what target to shoot at. And a man doesn't. He has to have someone else to choose his target, and he's not thinking for himself. They're doing the same thing for him. So, it was only when the country, when the Negro leaders, same way, the same type of Negro leader, Hank Dickey, Negro leaders in those days that we have today. When the Negro leaders saw all the white fellows being drafted and taken into the Army and dying on the battlefield, Negro were dying, so they weren't being drafted. The Negro leaders come up and said, "He's got to die too. We want to be drafted too. And we demand that you take us in there and let us die for our country." This is what the Negro leaders said back in 1940. I remember A. Philip Randolph was one of the leading Negroes in those days. Who said it? He's one of the big six right now. So, and this is why he's one of the big six right now. So, when they started drafting Negro soldiers then, and then they started letting Negroes get into the Navy, but not until Hitler and Tokyo and the foreign powers were strong enough to bring pressure upon this country so that it had its back to the wall and it needed us. And at that same time, they let us work in factories. Up until that time, we couldn't work in the factories. I'm talking about the North as well as the South. And when they let us work in the factories, we began, at first, when they let us in, we could only be janitors. Then after a year or so passed by, they let us work on machines. We became machinists, got a little skill. And as we got a little more skill, we made a little more money, which enabled us to live in a little better neighborhood. When we lived in a little better neighborhood, we went to a little better school, got a little better education, and could come out and get a little better job. So the cycle was broken somewhat, but the cycle was not broken because of some kind of sense of moral responsibility on the part of the government. No, the only time that cycle was broken even to a degree was when world pressure was brought to bear from the United States government, and they were forced to look at the Negro, and then they didn't even look at us as human beings. They just put us into their system and let us advance a little bit farther because it served their interest. But they never let us advance a little bit farther because they were interested in our interest or interested in us as human beings. Any of you who have a knowledge of history, social, political science, or the economic development, race relations. All you have to do is take what I'm telling you and go back and do some research on it, and you'll have to admit that this is true. It was then after, during the time that Hitler and Tojo, Japanese emperor, were able to make war with this country and put pressure upon them, Negroes in this country advanced a little bit. At the end of the war with Germany and Japan, then Joe Stalin was a threat. Joe Stalin and communist Russia were a threat. And during that period, we paid a little bit more attention. Now, the point that I'm making is this. Never at any time in the history of our people in this country have we made advances or advancement or made progress in any way just based upon the internal goodwill of this country or based upon the internal activity of this country. We have only made advancement in this country when this country was under pressure from forces above and beyond its control. Because the internal sense of, the internal moral consciousness of this country is bankrupt. It hasn't existed since they just brought us over here and made slaves out of us. They can trick up on the conversation and make it appear that they have our good interests at heart. But when you study it every time, no matter how many steps they take us forward, it's like we're standing on a, what you call that thing, a treadmill. That is, the treadmill is moving backwards faster than we're able to go forward in this direction. We're not even standing still. We're walking forward at the same time going backwards. So I say that because the Organization of Afro-American Unity is studying the process of this so-called progress during the past 20 years. We realize that it's the only time the black man in this country is given any kind of recognition or shown any kind of favor at all, or even his voice is listened to, is when America is afraid of outside pressure or when she's afraid of her image abroad. And so we could see that as long as we sat around and carried on our struggle at a level or in a manner that involved only the goodwill of the internal forces of this country, we would continue to go backwards if we know real meaningful changes made. So, the Organization of Afro-American Unity saw that it was necessary to expand the problem and the struggle of the black man in this country until it went above and beyond the jurisdiction of the United States. For the past 15 years, the struggle of the black man in this country was labeled as a civil rights struggle. And as such, it remained completely within the jurisdiction of the United States. You and I could get no kind of benefit whatsoever other than that which would be forthcoming from Washington, D.C., which meant, in order for it to be forthcoming from Washington, D.C., all of the congressmen and the senators would have to agree to it. But the congressmen, the most powerful congressmen and the most powerful senators were from the South. They were from the South because they had seniority in Washington, D.C., and they had seniority because our people in the South, where they came from, couldn't vote. They just didn't have the right to vote. So, we saw that we were up against a hopeless battle internally because of the necessity of getting allies on the world after world level, or from abroad, or from all over the world. And so immediately we realized that as long as the struggle was a civil rights struggle within under the jurisdiction of the United States, we would have no real allies or real support. We decided that the only way to make the problem rise to the level where we could get world support was to take it out of the civil rights label, or take it away from the civil rights label and put it in the human rights label. It's not an accident that the struggle of the black man in this country for the past 10 or 15 years has been called a struggle for civil rights. Because as long as you're struggling for civil rights, what you're doing is asking these racist segregationists who control Washington, D.C., and they control Washington, D.C. They control the federal government through these committees. And as long as this thing is a civil rights struggle, you're asking it at a level where your so-called benefactor is actually someone from the worst part of this country. And you can only go forward to the degree that they let you. But when you get involved in a struggle for human rights, it's completely out of the jurisdiction of the United States government. You take it to the United Nations. And if when you have any problem that is taken to the United Nations, the United States has no say-so on it whatsoever, because in the UN she only has one vote. And in the UN the largest block of votes is the African continent of Africa has the largest block of votes in any continent on this earth. and the continent of Africa, coupled with the Asian bloc and the Arab bloc, comprises the over two-thirds of the UN forces, and they're the boss nations. That's the only court that you can go to today and get your own people, people who look like you, on your side, to the United Nations. And this could have been done 15 years ago, could have been done 19 years ago. But they tricked us. They got a hold of our leaders and used our leaders to lead us right back to their courts, knowing that they control their courts. And so the leaders look like they're leading us against an enemy, but when you analyze the struggle that we've been involved in,